Coming up next on Lutheran Radio UK,
The Lutheran Inquisitor, examining pressing issues and their ramifications for the church today.
Hello and welcome to The Lutheran Inquisitor. I'm your host, John Ehlers. I'm pastor of Christ Lutheran Church in Orpington, Kent, which is a southeastern suburb of London. I'd like to invite you to come and join us for one of our worship services. We meet each Sunday at 10:30 a.m. I'd like to also invite you to attend our service down in Raynham, Kent. We meet the first Sunday of the month at 3 p.m. at the Evangelical Free Church on Wigmore Road. And I also help with St. Columba Lutheran Church in East Kilbride, Scotland. And they meet each Sunday morning at 11 a.m. So come and join us for a service if you live in any of those areas. And if you don't, go to our website, lutheran.co.uk. Click on the directory button. Find the congregation that's closest to you and go pay them a visit. I know you'll receive a very warm welcome. I'd also like to invite you to download our Lutheran Radio app. You can find this on the App Store, Google Play, or Windows Store. And take us with you wherever you go and have a listen. And you can listen to our podcast. You can catch up on the first two episodes we've been doing with Dr. Jeffrey Leininger. Dr. Leininger is the former associate pastor of Resurrection Lutheran Church in Cambridge. He served there while he was doing his MPhil and his PhD at Cambridge. He currently serves as the campus pastor for Concordia University in Chicago. And for the last couple of weeks, we've been talking about the antecedents of the English Reformation. We spoke the first time about the Lollards and their influence. Last week, we talked about the possible decay and decline of the church at the beginning of the 16th century and its influence on the English Reformation. And today we're going to talk about Renaissance humanism and its influence on the English Reformation. Jeff, welcome back.
Thanks so much, John. I'm really happy to be here.
It's great to have you with us again. And when we talk about Renaissance humanism, we hear the word humanism a lot today, but I suspect humanism today isn't what we mean by humanism back in the 16th century, is it?
That's right. Yeah, when we think about the Renaissance, we think about I like to use the term Renaissance Christian humanism, and that gives a little bit better idea that the humanists of the 16th century were all Christians. Some of them ended up being of the more evangelical or Lutheran or Protestant persuasions. Others remained faithful to their Catholic upbringings in the Catholic Church, but they were Christians for the most part. The term that they used in Latin is literati, which is letters, you know, of learning. And so when we talk about the antecedents or setting the stage or the groundwork for the English Reformation, the alliteration I use is one possibility would be Lollards. The other would be the lethargy of the traditional church. And last week we talked about how, in fact, the newest scholarship has shown how vibrant and adaptable the traditional church was and how deeply ingrained that piety was in the medieval, late medieval church. So we had Lollards as a possibility, lethargy as a possibility, and then literati, which are these Christian humanists. I think the way to think about Christian humanism, the Renaissance, the simple way of looking at it is the term ad fontes, back to the sources. And I'll give you a illustration from the United States, since I'm from this place called Minnesota, which is up in near Canada in the north. The question I'll ask you, John, since you've spent some time in the United States, if I was going to ask you to drink a glass of water, and I gave you two options. One is you can go all the way down south to New Orleans at the bottom of the Mississippi and take a nice deep drink of water down there. Or if you wanted to go to the very source of the Mississippi up in Lake Itasca in Minnesota, near where I'm from, in the spring-fed pure water, where are you going to drink your water from, John?
It's going to be Minnesota, Oofta.
You betcha.
We have the same thing here. When I go to Scotland, the water is beautiful, but when I drink it out of the Thames, I'm not so sure.
That's exactly right. And so that's the way to think about the Renaissance or the Christian humanism, ad fontes, to the sources. They want to drink from the original sources as much as possible in order to sort of avoid what they would might consider the many centuries of medieval corruption. And they do this in terms of the Bible. So they go back to the original languages of Hebrew in the Old Testament and Greek in the New Testament, rather than the Vulgate Latin, which was the official translation of the Catholic Church. So they go back to the original sources of the Bible, and they go back to the original sources in terms of philosophy, but also the classic and ancient world, like the plays and the education and the learning and reading Terence and Plautus and so this whole movement of the original sources, both biblical and non-biblical, and in their mind, it sort of brings this freshness to it. And in the term we use, Renaissance, is this awakening that happens.
Jeff, you talk about this Renaissance reawakening, talking about looking at the original texts in Christian documents and secular documents. So was it Christian? Was it secular? Was it a combination of both?
It was, especially with those that may have been influencing the Reformation, both on the continent and in England, is it was really a using it, the desire to improve civic and churchly life through the fresh examination of ancient texts, a simple Christ-like living, and a renewal of education. Now, that was their goal, and so it was. They wanted to improve society and the church, but their motivation was very Christian, very much from the gospel itself. They wanted to use these ancient texts to improve society in the name of Christ. And some names that we might think of are, of course, Erasmus is the most famous and the most prolific and incredibly talented of all the humanists. Erasmus never leaves the traditional Catholic Church. He wants renewal. He wants this reawakening, but he doesn't want the Catholic Church to fall. John Colet in England is an example. Again, doesn't leave the Catholic Church. John Skelton. We think of Thomas More as a very famous example, and he does not leave the Catholic Church. And we think of somebody like John Fisher, who founded St. John's College, Cambridge, with Lady Margaret Beaufort. And so these are Catholic Renaissance scholars. What is happening, however, though, is kind of like with the Lollards, as we talked about a couple of our sessions previous, is that what happens when you start reading these texts for yourself, especially the scriptures, John, I might ask you that question. What kind of things might be happening in your mind?
Yeah, again, you're seeing what the text says, not what somebody who translates it says it says.
Yeah, that's right. And you begin to maybe question some of the doctrines of the medieval church or some of the perspectives of the medieval church. You start to say, well, the Bible doesn't say a whole lot about the Pope being the head of the church. It talks about, Rome and places like that. And what, the Bible doesn't say a lot about purgatory, So you start to read these things for yourself and you start to raise these questions. And so early on, this Christian humanism is just everybody was, right? But then it starts to divide into those that had a more reformist view, such as Luther, and those that remained more faithful to the Catholic Church.
Now, Jeff, you talk about getting these original manuscripts to read from, but didn't they always have them? And how did they collect them? And how did they put them together, especially before the time of the printing press?
Wonderful question, John. I mean, some of the ancient sources actually come through the way of Islamic scholars, and it becomes also, some of them come from the Eastern Church when Constantinople, or we might call it Byzantium, when that empire falls, scholars flee from there and they flee into the West and they bring some things with them. But then they're also doing a lot of fresh discovery of them. And Erasmus himself being a main driving force behind this. in the invention of the printing press, it really expands greatly. Again, in about 1455, there's this massive output of original texts. There's this massive output of educational materials, and literacy starts to be on the rise. And so the older scholastic curriculum is replaced by an emphasis on the classics and on Bible reading. And so along with that, some is a critical, you know, there's some criticism of ecclesiastical abuses or of papal power, of medieval structures and medieval piety. And so, when we think about the Reformation, we have to keep in mind that there is a Catholic, if you want to call it that, there's a Catholic Reformation that is also happening, that is looking for renewal, but not to leave the church. In Lutheran circles, it becomes not just, John, about the renewal of the church, but it becomes about justification. It becomes about the gospel itself and justification by grace through faith. And that becomes a line, a dividing line between these Renaissance scholars. I mean, many of them are friends and they know each other, but then, the issue of Martin Luther and justification divides them. And then in England, the king's great matter divides them. The question of the king's divorce and can he start his own church, that ends up dividing them. And so in a lot of ways, it's a very sad story because you have, people that may have been colleagues and friends end up, being inquisitors to one another and end up, presiding over the burning of heretics. It's in a way, it's a very sad story too.
As you tell the story, it sounds like, though, it starts at the university level. And if that's the case, then how does it feed down into impacting the political level and then into general society?
Yeah, excellent. It does definitely start at the university level that in England, both Cambridge and Oxford, they have this humanist, Christian humanist learning. It's sometimes called the new learning. Although that term really is more properly understood in terms of the Protestant theology, but sometimes people use the term new learning. But it happens at the university level. But then now literacy, two things. One is the and they're related. The one is the printing press. So it's just a massive access to this. And the other would be the rising of literacy. So with the printing press, you know, a way to think about this is that in 1455, you know, there's one printing press and there's one book that's been printed and that is the Bible, right? Gutenberg's, the Gutenberg Bible. That's 1455. In 1500, John, there are dozens of presses all over Europe and there are 20 million books that have been printed. And so this expansion of knowledge is unprecedented. We think about like our cell phones and the internet and that being a great technological innovation, and it certainly is. But I mean, I would say the invention of the printing press is an even more dramatic example of that. Just things are exploding by exponentially. I mean, millions of books are printed in one generation. Hundreds of millions of books are printed in one generation, whereas previously there was nothing printed. And so the rising of literacy and the access to this, well, we might say the fresh water, access to the font itself, grows all over society. And it has a pretty dramatic impact.
You talk about the impact that it has on society, but how did it impact the English Reformation?
Great question. I mean, one way of people talk about that Erasmus laid the egg that Luther hatched. And that's kind of a funny way of saying it. But the point I think is pretty strong is that the reformers, both on the continent and in England, they have now access, because of the Christian humanism, they have access to, well, new ways of thinking, for one. Secondly, new texts, both historical and philosophical and sacred texts that really question and challenge a lot of the authority of the medieval church. And they have, as I said, the Bible itself. They can access that itself. And so in England in particular, people like Thomas Cromwell or Thomas Cranmer, they can look at histories now of England and say, well, the Pope hasn't always had as much power as he does now. Or then they may be able to make that case with Henry VIII. Or they can show in the scriptures that you're supposed to obey the king. But it doesn't say a lot about obeying the Pope. And so they have access to all of this new ideas and new information and new ways of thinking and new texts that enable them to challenge the established authority, and to challenge it in a way that says that actually our perspective is the older one, and the Pope's perspective is medieval and dark and not pure and invented. And so they use that perspective a lot when it comes to Henry VIII's great matter, to the publishing of the Bible in England, and to the challenging of many medieval doctrines such as transubstantiation and pilgrimages, the monastic institutions, they start to challenge those too. So the access to new ideas, new texts, both sacred and secular, enables people to think in new ways about how religion might be and how it might be shaped.
And as I understand it, this Renaissance Christian humanism got into Henry's court as well, including many of his wives. Anne Boleyn, Catherine Parr, Jane Seymour were all really substantially affected by this new humanism.
That is correct. And Henry himself, actually, we think of him as this overweight tyrant, you know, slaughtering his wives, which is, you know, there's some truth to that. But he starts out as a Renaissance prince. He knows Latin. He composes music. He is actually quite generous and charitable when he becomes king. We could do a whole section on Henry VIII himself. But then, of course, his wives, too. Anne Boleyn is very much influenced by this new learning. She is educated both in England, but also in France. She has influence. So it's there, and pretty much it takes over all the education of anybody. I mean, anybody that's going to be educated, whether you're Protestant or Catholic, is going to have great access to this classical world, new thinking, new ideas, new plays, new poetry, and new devotional material as well. So it is influencing everything. And so I think that when we return to kind of our broader question about what is the groundwork, what are the antecedents to the English Reformation, you know, the Lollards and the Wycliffe movement a century and a half before, yes, there are some elements there, but, you know, when you get actually down to the historical connections, maybe not so much. When you ask the question about the lethargy or the decline and decay of the traditional church, you can say, well, there's a lot of vibrancy there, so maybe that's not as strong of an influence. But when you get to this Renaissance Christian humanism, it's impossible to think about the Reformation happening without this having happened and people having access to this new learning. Luther himself, if we go back over to the continent in Germany, he is able to study the scriptures for himself. He is able to read the church fathers for himself. That's the other part, is all of the patristic stuff is being translated. And that really is able to have him think in new ways about his own personal religion and about the way religion, Christianity might be shaped. And so, it's pervasive. And as I said, that it's really hard to think that the English Reformation or the Reformation itself could have happened without this Renaissance humanism.
In some respects, is it like letting the genie out of the bottle to let people actually have access to these, particularly the scriptures, the original scriptures? And is that part of the reason why the Reformation was probably a bit rocky? You say there are those who are affected much more with the traditional aspects and those who are affected with the reformist aspects. Did they try to work together, or was this just a wedge that was never gonna be brought back together?
Yeah, that's a wonderful question. It is that the genie out of the bottle. they, you know, you can't, I don't think you can go back. I think that's the thing, is that once this whole movement, and it's this international movement, and it's not just Germans or English or French or whoever they might be, but there's this international movement. You know, once you've started drinking that pure water, you're not going to go back to the Thames, or you're not going to go back to New Orleans where the Mississippi is draining into the Gulf. You know, once you've drank that cool, clear water, you're never going back. But then it does become, the debates then becomes, well, how then do we translate the Bible? For example, the word we use, repentance, the traditional translation was do penance. The reforming translation was repent. So how do you translate these things? And so those debates then started to happening. How you talk about things, how you translate things, how you conceptualize religion makes a big difference in terms of where you're going to end up. And so the Catholic humanists use the new learning, the new access to this text for their purposes. They do reform. They do welcome certain changes. The Protestant reformers, they've drunk the pure water so much that they're saying that the Catholic Church is no longer the true church. We just can't reconcile the two anymore. And so that whole debate about how did they reconcile those that stayed within the Catholic Church and those that left the Catholic Church is a great discussion.
So, Jeff, you mentioned a number of these humanists remained within the traditional Roman Catholic Church. What kind of change did they really want to see as they remained?
Yeah, I think the maybe way of talking about is what they didn't want to see change is they didn't want core doctrines to change. And they didn't want this universal Christendom, this idea that we're all connected, the Pope being a central figure of that. They were very worried about that changing, but what they did want to change is they wanted better clergy, better educated clergy, clergy with more sincere piety, clergy with more moral lives following the life of Jesus. They wanted education. They wanted people to learn and to make the most of the new learning and the humanist discoveries. They wanted the authority of the church to be in check and in balance with the life of the church itself. And so a conciliar movement is a term that we use from earlier history, but like the role of councils, the role of clergy, not just bishops, at having a voice. That they wanted those type of things to change, and they did want vernacular too. They wanted some of the scriptures in the language of the people, though they were very cautious about that because they were worried that if people read the Bible for themselves, you can get in a lot of trouble doing that. But they were critical of some of the ecclesiastical abuses. But what they didn't want to change is this two parts. One is the core doctrines, you know, how you're saved, the idea of purgatory, transubstantiation. They didn't want those core doctrines to change, and they also didn't want to divide up and break up this universal Christendom. Those were the two things that really frightened them. So you can imagine sort of a Catholic humanist scholar like Erasmus or John Collett or whoever they might be is, yes, they want learning and they want teaching and they want piety, but it can only go so far. Whereas the Protestant reformers are, in a sense, willing to take it wherever it leads. And they do. And it does divide Christianity. And they do change the doctrines. And they, from a Lutheran perspective, you know, especially this idea of the gospel, of grace, of justification by grace through faith, that core rediscovery then ends up driving everything for them. And they're willing to break with the traditional church if it means that they can hold on to the sweetness of grace.
So, Jeff, as we're running out of time again, I was wondering, could you just summarize for us the influence of this Renaissance Christian in humanism for laying the groundwork to the English Reformation. If you could sum that up for us, please.
Just a couple things that come to mind is, first of all, they have access to new thinking, new ways of looking at the world, at the faith. There is access to patristics. There's access to the Bible in its original language. And that gives people the ability to question, the traditional authority. The other thing that it does is it really raises the question, broader questions, especially when it comes to Henry VIII and the English Reformation and his establishment of a new church, is, well, what about the authority of the Pope? Is the Pope the ultimate authority? And if we just get rid of the Pope, can we still be the church? And so those two questions really are very important for the groundwork for making the Reformation a possibility in England. And so I would say very strongly that without this new learning, this Christian, humanists, the literati, the educated people, without those things pouring in, these texts pouring in from the continent and going into places like Oxford and Cambridge, I just don't see how the Reformation could have happened. But those texts were available, and through the printing press were readily available. And so it very much caught people's imaginations, and it very much was able to help them think in new ways about things and have new possibilities, and therefore made the Reformation a possibility in England.
Dr. Jeff Leininger, we thank you for giving us this overview of Christian humanism and its influence upon the English Reformation. We deeply appreciate your learning, your time, and sharing that with us. And again, we invite you back next week as we look at your fourth L in the antecedents of the English Reformation, and we invite our listeners to join us then. Thanks.
Thank you for listening to The Lutheran Inquisitor with Pastor John Ehlers. If you have any questions or comments about the issues raised in this program, send an email to info@lutheranradio.co.uk. The podcast of this show is available from our website. Check our program online and stay tuned.